You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Osiris.
This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
Kick out the jams, motherfuckers. This is Wayne Kramer from the MC5, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology.
DIY and How Studios presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Hello, diggers. Welcome to another edition of Deeper Digs in Rock, a production of Rock and Roll Archaeology. Christian Swain here. I am the Rock and Roll Archaeologist, and I'm behind the mic at Aftermaster Studios in Hollywood today. In Deeper Digs, we go a little further, dig a little deeper into rock and roll music, culture, and technology. Interviews, special topics, field trips, and more. It's the companion show to the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast, our episodic overview of rock history. All of our podcasts, and we have a nice little network going now, are available at, say it with me people, all together now, rockandrollarchaeology.com. Podcasts, show notes, social media links, come and get it. And you can support us via Patreon or get you some cool rock and roll archaeology swag. Shirts, caps, stickers, coffee mugs. Yes, folks, stop by and check it out. Finally, and this is the one that matters most to us, if you enjoy what we do here, then please tell a friend about rock and roll archaeology. Okay, thank you. Business handled. We are good. Time to start digging, gang. Another fine interview for you today. So let's do it. So today, we're talking with Bob Lefsetz, author and publisher of the Lefsetz Letter. Some of you may be asking, the what letter? But those in the know are either nodding with approval or ready to pull the fire alarm. Yes, the Lefsetz Letter is the OG of music industry blogs. It was a blog before there even were blogs. It goes back to 1986. First, it was a mailed-out subscription newsletter that went mostly to music business types. Then in the 90s and early aughts, it was an email bulletin with about 10,000 subscribers. In 2005, the Lefsetz Letter went fully digital as a web blog. Bob is prolific. A dozen posts a week or more is not at all uncommon on this blog. But the thing we like about the Lefsetz Letter, well, we like a lot of things about it. We are regular readers, after all. What we like the best, Bob is fiercely independent. He's an iconoclast, a killer of sacred cows. More than a few times, he has shown a cheerful willingness to bite the hand that feeds him. As a thought leader and music industry observer, he gets it wrong sometimes, but he gets it right a lot more often. Ramble through the Lefsetz Letter archives, and you will see he spotted trends and called things correctly years before they actually happened. This kind of agenda-setting insight and willingness to call it like he sees it is why the Lefsetz letter is a must-read for music industry types and for the devoted rock and roll fan. And as you shall see in a moment, Bob is a bit of a raconteur. This was a really fun interview on our end. We had a great time getting to know him. Now it's your turn, so let's do it. Let's meet Mr. Bob Lefsetz, author of the Lefsetz Letter. Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, Bob Lefsetz.
Great to be here in Hollywood on a, what day is it, Thursday morning?
Thursday. Yeah. You live somewhere close. I think you're west side, right, in Santa Monica?
The west side.
Yeah. So, it's always nice to come into to town. And
well, it's funny. I just saw a woman walking down the street with her, you know, pearl shoes and her look on. I said, this is like the 1970s all over again. I don't know what's going on.
You find it all here.
Right.
Yeah, definitely find it all here. All right. So let's start at the beginning. Let's get the Bob Lefsetz origin story, the superhero origin story. I think you're born in 1953.
Yeah. Now that that's on Wikipedia, I guess your age is out there.
Yeah.
But yes, I am born in 1953.
Yeah. And you grew up in Connecticut and are thoroughly, through and through, a baby boomer.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut, which is 50 miles from New York City. So you get New York media, New York radio, New York television. Went to college in Vermont. I'm a big skier, was a starving freestyle skier in Utah, and then went to law school in L.A., and here I am.
Yeah, yeah. So, and we'll talk a little bit about that because I know you're still a big ski bum.
Absolutely.
In fact, I think that really was, you wanted to be that, that was your vocation in life.
Well, that and skiing, I said, you know, okay, are we going to get into this? Yeah, I can ski on anything, but I need snow.
Yeah.
And the last year I was in college happened to be a really bad year.
Yeah.
And at the time, I either wanted to write for Rolling Stone or be a freestyle skier, and I chose freestyle skiing first.
Right, right. And now you've got to do both.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm not complaining about it.
Right. So tell us about music discovery for you. As a youngster, what was the first artist that really turned your world?
Well, I grew up in a household with a lot of music. My father played the violin poorly, and we listened to a lot of show tunes. That's the first music I remember. And then I certainly remember buying comedy records. So I remember getting The Martian Hop by the Randells. And then I immediately went to albums after that.
So 63, you said your mom was
She was leaving on Friday night, and she was saying, you got to watch Jack Parr tonight. You know, my mother, I think Jack Parr was on at 10. She didn't care that we were up till 10. We weren't that old. Mm-hmm. And if you look it up, you know, all this stuff is resurfaced online because people never really believed this story when I told them. But Jack Parr had, it must have been a kinescope if you want to really get technologically oriented, but it's basically a video of the Beatles performing, shot from the back of the audience in a theater, and they were playing She Loves You.
Probably in the UK, right?
Right. Definitely in the UK. And we thought it was We Love To, Yeah, 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 okay? And we laughed.
We Love To, Yeah, Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, and there was so much screaming, et cetera. So that's the first time I saw the Beatles. And then, of course, right after the beginning of the year, 1964, you immediately heard I Want to Hold Your Hand on the radio. I remember hearing it the first time, saying, I don't really get it. By one day, everybody was a maniac.
Yeah, yeah. It changed music overnight. You know, I've interviewed some people, like, for example, Zildjian Cymbals.
Right.
They said that within a week, their back order had gone from a few days to, in the end, 15 years.
Well, it's funny. I worked at a summer camp years ago, and the Zildjian kids went there. That's a name.
Oh, yeah. Know it's gonna be the especially symbols. In the, yeah.
So, but in any event, But people have to realize it was a really big change of what had come before. There had always been music.
Yeah.
Perry Como, of course, and, Frank Sinatra. And the Four Seasons. I was a huge Four Seasons fan. But this was definitely a great leap forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why? Is it because they took American music and then reinvented it in a way and sent it back over the ocean?
First and foremost, they were believable. They were singing the songs. It sounded like it came straight from their hearts.
It did. It's that's, like if you that's go to, a big, you go to like huge point. Four Seasons, it's not a bunch of writers in the back room. Right. It's all self-contained.
But if you go like to the Four Seasons, and I'm a huge Four Seasons fan, mm-hmm. you know, they're singing, you know, Ronnie and some of the Ragdoll, but it always seemed like a third party. Didn't seem like it was literally happening right to them.
Mm-hmm.
Where when you have the Beatles, like All My Loving, okay? And I remember on Ed Sullivan, underneath it, it said, you know, when John was saying, sorry, girls, he's married. Mm-hmm. You know, All My Loving, you know, send it home to you.
Oh, that's right. They posted that over exactly. on the screen, so, right.
And then, unlike with other things, and this is an interesting thing because it's happening again today, what is the release schedule? There was an endless tsunami of material,
mm-hmm.
okay, mm-hmm. which we were not expecting or used to. And don't forget, there was the Capitol Meet the Beatles, and there was VJ introducing the Beatles, and then the Beatles' second album, and then in July came Hard Day's Night, both the soundtrack and the album. I mean, you know, people, Randy Bachman did a whole video about this, you know, the intro chord to Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
So we immediately heard it. It's like, wow.
But, yeah, and so it took decades for people to figure that out.
Right.
I know Randy did a show specifically on breaking down that.
Right.
He met Giles serendipitously, ended up at Abbey Road, and they kind of took the stems and took it apart and found you know, the key in that. There was a lot going on. It's not right. just a D chord or something like that. So very interesting. So, all right. So I believe you went to Middlebury College in Vermont. And again, as we said, you're a big skier, and that was probably the case.
Okay, well, there are
two
things there. I mean, yes, I worked hard. I wanted to get into a good school. I could have gone to school at Columbia in New York City, and I didn't go primarily because there was a guy who wanted a room with me who I'd been on a summer program with, and I didn't want to do that. And I did want to go to Middlebury. It's a beautiful campus. You know, I went in the dark era, you know, when there was one snowy TV station, there weren't DVDs, et cetera. Yeah. Today, no place is really the hinterlands.
No.
But I'm in college in the 70s. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And the college was co-ed. It had its own ski area. But this was a tumultuous time politically and economically in the United States. And certainly growing up in the suburbs, I was exposed to that. But going to Middlebury College, you were really off the grid. And 45% of the people were prep school kids, which gave me a good education into their mindset. But it was, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't go back. It was very conservative academically. I was known as the guy with all the records. I taught a course in rock music. Middlebury, they now call it J-Term, but when I went there, it was called the 414 system. There was one course you took intensively in January, and I taught a course on rock music. So,
back in the 70s.
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
That was January of 73. Mm-hmm. Believe me, you know, I was really into it.
Right. And still are today.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we could talk specifically about today when we get there.
All right. So I believe art history is your major?
Wow, you're really going deep. Yes, I was an art history major. I go really in deep on all these stories on why I was an art history major.
No, why were you an art history major?
I was an English major. I mean, people don't usually go to a college like Middlebury. They have no idea how rigid it is. There's no business. There's nothing practical whatsoever. You could take science courses.
It's all liberal arts.
But it's all liberal arts. And English and American literature are two different departments.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the English department, you're literally not reading books written in America. And I loved reading because I love to give my own take on things. They didn't want to give you your own take. They didn't care about your own take. They wanted you to get the classical take, which is not – I wasn't interested in that at all. And these friends said, you got to take art history. The teacher's great. Talks about ice cream shops. And it was, and I evolved. It was much more my mindset.
More rebellious, perhaps.
You know, if there could be rebellion in Middlebury. I was certainly a rebellious person and got in – I don't know if I want to call it trouble, but was noted for that. And there were some consequences. But yes, I was an art history major.
Okay, so who's your favorite painter?
Wow. You know, my two favorite eras are early Netherlandish painting and modern abstract stuff. Although, if I could only own one painting, it would be Demoiselles d'Avignon, the Picasso one, where it looks like the women are standing with masks. Before they redecorated MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, you go in, and it would be at the end of the hall. Okay, this was the turning point.
And this is MoMA in New York City.
And now, I was in the museum not that long ago, a couple of months ago, in July. I don't know when this will be aired, July of 2018. And it is still there, but people want to see, Starry, Starry Night. But Demoiselles d'Avignon, people have to know about art because they'll see a lot of major, modern art. And they'll say, I could do that. But yes, could you have the conception? This is the same thing. Let's go to the Ramones, okay? So people might say, the Ramones have a good rep now. They did not have a good rep then.
At the
people
time,
say,
right.
Hey, they couldn't play whatever. They came up with the idea. Nobody else had the idea. So the Protractor series in modern art, there's a lot of stuff, and especially, you'll see in minimalism. You say, I could do that. Yeah, but you didn't have the idea.
Okay. I think you've proved your bona fides here. You still love it. You still love the...
Don't push me to... No. I believe... listen. When art stimulates and sets you free, that's what I'm into. It could be a TV show.
Yeah.
It could be a movie. It could be a record. It could be a work of art. But we live in an era where everyone's focused on business and science. Those are valuable elements of society, but they don't touch you in the same way.
Agreed. And maybe we've stepped too far away from the garden, basically.
Well, I think the whole society is very coarse. I have a whole theory about this. I believe it's about income inequality. In the 60s and 70s, no one ever wanted their child to be a musician.
Right.
That was always seen as a rough thing. But if you went to public school, and I went to public school in the suburbs, there were always the art kids,
mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Could be the most beautiful girl in the school, but they know that she was an outsider. And the guys, too, it could be the most handsome guy, etc. And they were known as being different. Those were the ones who became musicians. The head of the football team, the cheerleader, they were never musicians. Mm. So you'd say, hey, I knew that person. Like someone from my town became a studio bass player. Well, I won't mention his name, but, he was arrested for drugs in high school. He was out playing late. These were not your average person in school. And when they made it, they had middle-class values. The example I always use is Jefferson Airplane, from the Volunteers album. They said, up against the wall, motherfucker, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Today, since life is so hard, if you have the ability to go to college, et cetera, you want to establish a nest egg. You want to establish a base. You don't want to – I used to get email 10 years ago from people saying, well, I'm graduating from college. I'm going to try this music thing for a couple of years before I go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even get that anymore, okay? So generally speaking, if you're on the education track, you're not taking a risk because the odds are too long. So the lower classes are the ones making music today with a different background. They're saying they will do whatever they're told to do, where the middle class person will say no. So music today is all about sponsorship and, maybe to a degree ripping off the man, but it's not about speaking truth to power like it was in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think a big shift is political. I mean, you are at the end of a liberal cycle, probably began in 1933. And by the time you get Nixon, you start to shift to a more conservative cycle. Certainly after Reagan, it is all.
Well, it's hard to watch. I mean, having lived through that era
where
you went to college and you literally could point out every Republican in college and everybody who was a music fan was a liberal. If you go to Reagan, he legitimized greed. And then, the fact that we could have Christie, who was governor of New Jersey, big Springsteen fan. It's just antithetical.
Yeah. Yeah. He's obviously not paying that much attention to the lyrics.
Right. But it's a sad state of affairs.
So you're also a lawyer.
Yes, I am.
And like you said, I think the plan was to be a ski bum.
No. I was not going to be a skier forever. And what happens when you are living in it, I was in Salt Lake City, which is a very weird place to be a ski bum because you live in Salt Lake, which is a city, mm-hmm. and you drive up to
the
mountains.
Right.
As opposed to being in Vermont and almost every other ski area in America, you're living in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But without going deeper into how weird that is, you wake up one day and you say, if I don't leave now, I'm going to be here forever. And you would see people who move to ski at Snowbird, which Snowbird and Alta are the most difficult skiing in Utah. And suddenly they were working for the phone company. I say, well, that's not going to be me. And my father always wanted me to go to law school. I had signed up for the LSAT when I was in college, and my friends knocked on the door and they said, you're not going to take that test. And I said, you're right. And I can't believe that I'm telling this story. And we went to Montreal overnight, and we went to see Bang the Drum Slowly. Isn't that the Robert De Niro movie? Uh-huh. But then I broke my leg in a freak accident before the ski season began. I took the LSAT, still wasn't a go. And the next year I got the world's worst case of mononucleosis. And my father said he would pay, so I went. And my theory was, in the time, a lot of the record companies were run by attorneys. That is not the case now.
Yeah. It was a shift from the old record men to the attorneys.
Exactly. My father was a real estate appraiser, so I certainly had no connections. So I saw that as a way in. Mm-hmm. I went to law school. I hated it, but a couple of things happened. One, I fell in with a woman.
And that was Southwestern.
Yeah, Southwestern Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And then two, it was until a couple of years ago, it was literally the worst year in the history of snow in Utah, 76, 77. I used to say people could look it up. They never believed me, but since we had a bad year the other year, they say yes. And I would call my friends and say, don't come. I was going to go for Christmas. Don't come. There's no snow. So I was involved with this woman, carried me through law school. And certainly going to law school, I was going to take the bar. When you take the bar in California, it takes like 5 or 6 months to get your results. In the interim, I got a job working for an attorney. And then I did pass the bar. And very shortly thereafter, I stopped practicing law, but then he called me back and I practiced some law some more. So, I mean, I could practice law tomorrow, but that's not something I've done for decades.
So let's get into the music business because, you know, as you said, lawyers are taking over the record industry in the 70s. And I think you have said that back then in the 1970s, it was virtually impossible to get into the music business. Who worked at Tower Records were in the music business.
You couldn't get a job at Tower Records. Yeah. Yeah. That's what cracks me up. People say, they don't understand. That's like joining the Yankees.
Yeah. So how did you crack into the music business?
Oh, God, it's a long story. I mean, you know, some of these lessons still apply. If you come from outside Los Angeles, you have to be here for about 2 years to find out who's full of shit and who's not. We can swear here, right?
Yeah, of course.
Everyone in Los Angeles has a good story. In addition, I mean, I use this example all the time.
The land of hope and dreams, man. Yeah, fruits and nuts.
You know, if – let's assume you broke your leg and you wouldn't – if your friend said, you know, I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos. Don't go to the doctor. You know, I can set your leg. You go, you're nuts, okay? But there's no criterion that makes you qualified for the music business. Ironically, and I know I'm going to piss people off here, those people who go to music business school are usually the least qualified. They're not the least qualified, but they're not qualified. If you know the people to this day running the music business, they're big risk takers. They're larger than life personalities. Yeah. It's got to do with their personality. They would probably be successful at anything they did. Mm-hmm. But in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of money in music relative to other things and a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. So that was the landscape.
That seemed attractive to you, and obviously
people don't understand today, unless they're of our vintage, is music drove the culture in the 60s and 70s. Mm. Everybody as a baby boomer will remember getting their first transistor radio. Mm-hmm. And you put it under your pillow, and you had the 9-volt battery, and to check whether it was still valid, you put your tongue up against the end. And at first, if you were a guy, you were listening to the baseball games. But then you would literally put the transistor next to your blotter while you did your homework. You would listen to the countdown. Everything was about music. Now, in addition to music testing limits, you also have to think there were not many other options. I mean, I grew up in the New York media market, so we had 3 network television stations and 3 independents. The only place they had more was in Los Angeles. We had 4 independents. Mm-hmm. But music was the heartbeat of the youth culture.
Yep.
And in 1967 in New York, when we had WOR-FM, because of the change in law, they couldn't broadcast on the FM what they did on the AM. And we suddenly had what was labeled underground FM radio. That was just incredible. It was the heartbeat. Even into the 70s, we had the big radio stations, which were codified in playlist by Lee Abrams, the big consultant.
Yep.
But they would have their own news. You really felt like if you wanted to touch in with your age group, you wanted to listen to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Where now, if you talk to people under the age of 20, none of them listen to the radio.
No. So, here's a question then. I mean, what do you think the future is of radio? I know you have a XM Sirius.
You know, we live in an era of cacophony. There's so many messages.
Yes.
And it's hard to get your message across. In addition, even looking at politics, everybody's working the refs 24/7. So whenever I write anything negative about radio, which I do on a regular basis, I hear from everybody in radio. I'm talking about terrestrial radio.
Mm-hmm.
Satellite radios and, you know, radio that's generated by Pandora and Apple Music and Spotify. I'm talking about the automatic generation, not Beats 1, which I think is a joke. Those are a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I write about radio, they immediately say, oh, no, you're wrong, and they whip out statistics. And then whenever I'm speaking, I always ask, anybody here, they all have children. Any of your children under the age of 20 listen to the radio? Crickets. None.
Nope.
So what do we know? We live in an on-demand culture. That's the way it is. Radio is not on-demand. Theoretically, if someone created story radio where music were part of it, maybe there's a possibility there. But the concept of having the Jive DJ playing the usual songs, hey, you're left-handed, shows your creativity, seeing him right here, that's history.
So story radio, what do you mean by that?
Like which radio?
Well, you said if somebody can create stories and music.
Listen, it's all about ideas are a dime a dozen. But execution is everything. The example
Fire Sign Theater. The perspiration is the real one.
Fire Sign Theater, we used to sit and listen to those records. Uh-huh. They'd be an album long, and we would stay there. Could someone create a radio show with music? Yes, but music would probably not be the driving factor. On some level, it's what we're doing here now. We're talking about music.
Yeah.
Okay? So is that a possibility? Yes. I don't think that's the future of exposing people to new tunes.
So back to the music industry, as we discussed, it's virtually impossible to get into it into the 70s, but you do.
Okay, so I certainly, while I was in law school, I would take courses at UCLA Extension. I will be honest. I didn't tend to learn anything, but I would meet like-minded people. That's one of the great things. I mean, I went to college in Vermont. I was the outcast. I came to L.A. I knew all these people who went to UCLA. They were just like me,
Listening
for the records, et cetera. So I would go to a million shows. And I went to work. I got a job waiting for my bar results for an attorney who represented some people who worked on a very big act, and there were huge publishing issues. And I worked on that, not that I really wanted to do that. And then I would negotiate for songs to be in movies. And then I tried to be a manager. That's when I quit being a – this is not long after I passed the bar. And I starved. Mm. Once again, it takes a long time to figure out how the world really works. As much as I knew – it's like people say, I know about records. I could work in the music business. Forget it. You have to fill a role that's needed. Or if you know that much, find a talented act. If you can find that act, the doors are open to you.
That would be the way to do it.
Right. So in any event, rushing through this story, I went back to work for the attorney. He'd gotten a very big movie client. I was working there. I would be doing the music work primarily on that particular thing, although some of just the movie deals. And then my sister had gone to college with someone who was one of the initial bookers on Entertainment Tonight. For those, you know, they have all these shows. They have talent bookers, a range of guests.
Yeah, yeah.
And she introduced me to the guy who did the music booking. And he introduced me to this movie producer who was going to start a music video cassette company. I went to work for this guy, Charles Band. We had a lot of divisions. You know, we sold horror video games. We sold horror DVD, that time, video cassettes. And he made a lot of movies. And we put this band Wasp in one of our movies. I maintained a relationship with Wasp. And then I went to work for Sanctuary Music, which managed Wasp and Iron Maiden.
And that didn't last too long.
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny. I'm still pissed at this guy.
Blackie Lawless?
This guy in Wired, you know, I resisted doing an interview for months years, actually. And then he says, I said, let's do it in your hotel room. And he said, no, you won't be good. I said, believe me, I'll be good in your hotel room. You won't be good. People are going to say, well, let's go to lunch. He goes, I have a credit card. Where do you want to go? Anywhere you want to go. And I said, well, why don't we go to the hotel room? And then if I'm not good, we'll go to the lunch. No, where do you want to go? I said, well, let's go to the Four Seasons for Sunday brunch. So he writes in the article, Lefsetz,
demands we went where he four wants seasons. To go.
It's like, come on. And then he asked, the story with Sanctuary Music, there's so many details. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a few of them. Mm. Under the law, you can only be in the United States for a certain number of days without paying tax. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the two guys who ran the company, they could only be in America a certain amount. I was the heavy. Okay. I had to negotiate. I'll give you a good example. Wasp, we were going to make a video and we had a huge advance and I had control of that advance. And we needed a $15,000 payment from Capitol Records, which they were contractually obligated to do. And I called for the payment and they say, we only write checks on Thursday. And I said, I'm filming on this is true. We're filming on Wednesday. And you check, no, we only write checks on Thursday. I said, so I got a hold of Rod Smallwood, who's still the manager of Iron Maiden. And I said, what do you want me to do here? He goes, well, that's why I hired you. You go in there.
Go figure it out.
So I had
out,
to
right.
tell this guy, Gary Culpepper was the attorney. I had to say, listen, either you write me the $15,000 check or I got to shut the video down and I'm going to bill you for the $10,000 I'm in. And of course I got the check. Mm-hmm. To get very specific, Blackie Lawless and the band Wasp, they wanted to produce themselves. Blackie Lawless wanted to produce it. But Capitol Records said no. So they got this guy, Mike Varney, who'd found all the Flash guitars to produce the record. The record came in mixed, and it was terrible. Okay? So I had to tell Blackie, I think we need to change. And people have no idea. They see the surface story of what's going on. I think we need to get this remixed. So he goes, I'll only remix it if Carter says to remix it. John Carter was an A&R guy, most famous shortly thereafter by producing the Tina Turner comeback record. And so I set up a meeting with Carter, and I played him the track. And he goes, I passed on this band three times. They were signed over me. Do whatever you want.
Ugh.
Now I'm freaked out. I'm back in my office, which was in a house on Weatherly above the Rainbow, which, in any event, and I ran there, and Blackie had played it for a few other people, and he brought me some Mrs. Fields cookies, said, we'll remix it. I got this guy, Dwayne Barron, who had just had a huge hit with Quiet Riot to mm-hmm. remix it. Mm-hmm. You also have to understand, bands had huge plans then, okay? Blackie wanted to use a song. It was a hard-driving metal track. And if you were alive during the MTV era, they would change philosophy now and again. We're playing hard music. We're not playing hard music, whatever.
Really?
Absolutely. And Dwayne had done a miraculous job making another track stand out called Love Machine, okay? I Want to Be Somebody was the track that Blackie had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I argued for Love Machine, mm-hmm. okay? Because I said, they changed the philosophy, and MTV will go on this, and et cetera. We have a good video.
Oh, okay, makes sense.
And then Rod called me, and I was fighting for the good of the album. And he said, what difference does it make if the first album only sells 50,000 copies? Which is the exact opposite of me. So standing up for artistic things, they fired me.
Yeah. So you're unemployed. And that gets us to the original Lefsetz letter.
Well, as I say, the nature of those jobs, you can't spend a dollar because you're working around the clock.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had enough money to last me like a year and a half.
Mm.
And I worked on a couple of movies. I had a big job. So you start to getting, they saw you as like a big person. So getting another job was difficult.
Yeah.
And yes, I started the newsletter in 1986.
So, and I think you began with a biweekly newsletter.
Yeah, it came out every other week. It was printed and you paid for a subscription.
And what did you charge?
It was $89 for 1 year, $165 for two.
And you got 3,000 subscriptions very quickly?
Well, I got everybody who was anybody subscribed.
You did.
I was The only person who canceled his subscription was Clive Davis, said something that pissed him off. But the I was really writing it as an advertisement for myself to get another job.
Uh-huh.
And I had a target number that if I reached, I would continue. I did. And I did continue.
So so it was kind of like a little like a cook report sort of thing.
You know, it was very much, but I write much more frequently. Every story was an article. I mean, excuse me, every article had an angle.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like tips. I don't mean tips like what record would be going up the chart, but how to increase your business, you know, signing acts, all about the business itself.
And then through that, you start consulting with the
record companies. Absolutely.
Yeah, so, and what kind of thing were they looking at? Was this in the 90s that you begin doing that?
It was the 80s and 90s. I didn't really do that much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go into the specifics. I don't think it's really that interesting. But they would call you up and they would have ideas, you know, help us, you know, what should we do on this record, that record, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's just a lot of change going on in the music business.
But what you realize is these record companies have priorities. Okay. And they really only want to work the priorities and any angle you can get them to help those priorities.
Right.
At the time.
Well, it's no different than any other corporation.
No. But they have many more products and many more products fail.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you go in there and you say, well, you gave me 15 CDs and this one I really love, we should do something with this. They go, that's not a priority.
Mm-hmm. So this is the height of the music industry as far as sales is concerned. I mean,
yeah, it really
CDs
was.
Well, it
wasn't a good
huge
time for me emotionally and financially, but it was the height. You're right.
You know, you have MTV still playing videos at
right,
that
although
time.
MTV, I mean, you know, in the early 90s, you get the beginning of the indie era. But the MTV videos are slick by then, but there's all kinds of acts being very successful.
So do you think that grunge was the last big movement in rock?
Are we shifting gears to a discussion of whether rock is dead and where rock is at?
Yeah, maybe.
For those of us who've been around, the fascinating thing was every 3 years we would have a new sound.
That's right.
So grunge killed hair band music,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And then one could argue that hip-hop killed grunge.
Mm-hmm.
But hip-hop has now gotten, you know, a 20-year run.
Yeah.
There's nothing inherently wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But we were used – and the other thing was, if you go back to the 60s, you know, a big hit would have maybe 6 weeks on the chart. Where now records can be on the chart for a year.
Oh, it's so ephemeral.
I mean, if you are an unknown act, it can take you a year for your track to be on the radio, so to speak.
Right.
Where if you're a hit act, can go immediately. It's much less fluid than it used to be. So do I believe rock is dead? Yes. Let's go back. For those of us who lived through the era of classic rock, there will always be music.
Of course.
There will always be music to listen to. Yeah. But when people, especially boomers, say, oh, you just don't get the young music or whatever, that's usually self-satisfying. That's, you know, the same people get plastic surgery and want to hang and look with the young people. There was one renaissance in painting and sculpture. They've painted and sculpted for 500 years thereafter.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
But there was only one renaissance. There was only one classic rock period.
Mm.
There was supposed to be a new Beatles forever. There was never a new Beatles.
Never happened.
Okay?
Right.
So people have to accept
there were bands or artists that ruled a period of time.
It could come back, mm-hmm. but there was a confluence of factors mm-hmm. that made it so big back then.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to rock, and rock specifically, it evolved, as I say, from the two-minute single to the album side, FM radio, to classic, to corporate rock, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had punk and new wave that tore it all down. Then we had grunge.
Mm-hmm.
Now everything is too self-referential. You have to have a decoder ring to understand this. I'll give you a good example. When Led Zeppelin came out, Led Zeppelin was considered heavy metal.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And Black Sabbath was the end. You put on today what people consider to be metal, unless they've listened to all the iterations for decades, they can't understand it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Metallica, the Beatles of metal at this point in time, mm-hmm. that's much further down the line than Led Zeppelin
Black Sabbath. Deep Purple.
So
right.
they have an audience. I mean, all these acts have an audience, mm-hmm. but it is a smaller part of the audience.
It's not a cultural driver.
Well, it's a cultural driver for the people who are listening.
Yeah, but it's
I'm
a
making
much,
a slightly different
smaller,
point. If you look at hip-hop, okay, there's 50% of the audience will just never listen to hip-hop, categorically against it, not a judgment of the quality. So who's the biggest act in the world today? Probably Adele. Okay. Mm-hmm. She hasn't put out a record for a while. The last record wasn't as good and it wasn't on streaming services, but let's use her as an example. So what do we know? She doesn't whore herself out. I hate to use that term relative to a woman, but in the industry, it means is she won't take money from anybody.
Right.
She won't do sponsorships, et cetera. So it's based on the music. What do we have? We have a woman with a phenomenal voice singing melody.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be what people want. I mean, if you go back to the album 21, when it was that was their second of three albums, when I was out to dinner with Jason Flom and some other people, and he said, okay, that sold 10 million copies when everything else sold 1 million copy. Does that mean in the era of Kid Rock, et cetera, when we had diamond sellers of 10 million sellers, would she have sold 100 million?
Wow.
So you have to ask whether it's a lost formula. We have to get back to the garden. If you go back to the Beatles, not only were they all good looking, they all had good voices. They all could play the songs. It's not a miracle. You have a verse, you have a chorus, you have a bridge. It's like, you know, it's like the Aztecs. We've lost the formula.
So it just needs to be rediscovered is what you're saying.
I think if you rediscover it, well, if we go to the turn of the century, we had the Backstreet Boys. Max Martin is a genius. Okay, he was the producer. He's from Sweden.
Yep.
But if you listen to those records, some of the lyrics are vapid. Okay. But if you listen to Backstreet Boys Millennium, they were so big. I'm not as big an NSYNC fan, but you can listen to those records forever because they got the elements of what this music was when everybody who was supposedly hip was going too far down the rabbit hole.
So do you think that we made the point that culturally there's a bit of a shift? We move from a dominating homogenous sound of the 60s and 70s and maybe even into the 80s a little bit. And then now a new sound begins to rise from the urban streets, hip hop, that then begins to change. And that shift seems to be in the 1990s, as we've just talked about.
Okay.
But there are also technological changes that are occurring here. So there's the cultural shift. So now the technological shifts, you have SoundScan that starts in 1991, I believe.
Oh, the SoundScan basically proved there was a huge demand for country music.
And then country music itself, too, comes in. And now, instead of a singular monolithic culture, you begin to see these divisions and these breakouts that, one only listens to this and never would listen to the other. And it's gotten even more diverse, which in some ways is good, but it also has separated us as a singular culture.
Well, we got to get very specific. You know, things really changed once the internet and Napster came along.
Yeah, 1995 and 1997. So 1995, Windows 95 comes out, PC becomes ubiquitous, everybody's got one in the home, and I think Napster comes out in 97, right?
I think it's 99 or 98, but actually.
Yeah, and that craters the music industry.
Yes, but talking artistically as opposed to economically, okay, suddenly everything surfaces. If we go now at this late date of 2018 – hip-hop dominates for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that hip-hop embraced the internet.
Yeah.
Everybody's posting stuff at SoundCloud. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the rock and pop world, especially the rock world, the internet was the enemy.
Yes.
The internet's ripping us off.
Yeah.
To this day, people say Spotify's the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unless you get your audience on the streaming service, your records will never surface. If you follow the statistics, country has made huge inroads on Spotify and streaming services. It's rock that has been left out. All these artists, I mean, I can't believe at this late date I'm even saying, you should be telling your fans, forget vinyl, which is like Civil War reenactment, sign up for the streaming service so that the people will see there's some action there and things will happen.
So the record is really the advertisement for the act.
It is, as
it's
I say.
It's just a piece.
But instead of, record revenue, recording revenue is going back up.
Yeah.
Instead
I think,
of, instead of seeing it as a shift to touring income, I would see it as there's many more opportunities to monetize than there ever were before. So there's a lot of ways you can make money. And it's good. I mean, it's so hard to get noticed. That's really the biggest problem. But the other thing is...
So there, it's a sea of mediocrity out there because everybody's got, GarageBand or Pro Tools or Logic or what have you. They've got their home studios. They build their product in whatever genre it is. And then they can, distribute it pretty easily, just as good as anybody can.
I mean, you're speaking my language. If it's not great, we're not interested. And there's a lot of canards in society. I mean, people say kids today have a short attention span. That is complete fucking horseshit.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Every year, somebody dies in Asia from playing video games like 3 days straight. Yeah. Look at kids. Kids watch Netflix marathons all days on Saturday or whatever. Bottom line is they have an incredible shit detector.
Yeah.
It's like people say, listen to my record 5 or 6 times again. What are you, nuts?
Yeah.
I mean, no one's got that time. Yeah. You got to catch me immediately. Musicians, they hate when I say this. Musicians are the worst. They're the most out of touch. They hate that the paradigm died. What they want to do is they want to be rescued by the record company and kept alive by the record company.
Yeah.
Okay, not knowing that probably if it was a pre-internet era, they wouldn't even be able to get a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get the acts that used to get record deals. Even if they didn't get any radio play, they got a certain amount of press so they could get a career. Now they're bitching that they're not getting any money from Spotify. You can check the statistics are public on Spotify.
Yeah.
It's like no one's listening. You were propped up by the artificial situation. So hip-hop has embraced all the new game. The other thing hip-hop does, if it doesn't work, they put out a new track. Where the record, the rock people say, well, I labored for a couple of years.
Oh, to make an album. And
right.
I think we both agree the album
today,
is dead.
I have a friend, Richard Griffiths, managed One Direction, used to run Epic, a lot of other things. He says, failure used to taint you. It doesn't taint you anymore. Okay, no one paid attention. Make another record.
Yeah.
Everyone is playing by the old rules to their detriment.
Hmm. So what are the new rules?
New rules is you're going to fucking starve. Okay.
Well, that's the way
it's harder than ever
before. The bands did the same thing.
It used to be that if you caught fire, you could see your way up. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to reach a level of ubiquity, the only person who has any ubiquity in America is Trump. Okay. So to get everybody to notice you, yes, in the hip hop world, they're featured on each other's records and they lift each other up. Okay.
So everybody needs to become a bozo con man?
I would not go. That's trying to rig the market. And now at this point, the audience is very sophisticated when they're manipulated.
So
let me just finish point, then I'll answer your question. My point is, it used to be 10 years ago, if you did something great, people would find it online.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's so much information that even if you do something great, it won't be found. So with that being the paradigm, the first incredible hurdle is doing something great. Most people can never do this.
And that takes time. It takes effort. It takes help.
It takes money. If you do something great, aligning yourself with the right people, getting noticed, that could take another 10 years.
Wow. That doesn't play well for young people who make music and are attempting to make a living, and
I don't give a shit about people making a living making music.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't believe people are entitled to make a living making music. And if you really want to make a living that badly, you can be a wedding band, although to a certain degree they have DJs now. There's a certain number of people who can play live. I lament the loss of clubs. I'm driving here, I'm driving past Club Lingerie. It didn't close because they wanted to. It closed because no one wanted to go anymore.
True.
Okay?
True, yeah.
So
supply and demand.
We have a limited number. Let's look at computers. There used to be a million brands of computers. How many brands are at this point in time?
Yeah.
Apple, Lenovo, Acer, and HP, and that's basically it.
Yeah.
This is the nature of the game.
Well, everything consolidates over
the
time.
The other thing about it, I was watching a movie last night, happened to be a ski movie, and they were talking about, first this guy's a famous extreme skier, Scott Schmidt. How did he get in the movie, okay? They were at Squaw Valley, which is notorious for extreme skiing, and the cinematographers for Warren Miller was this big ski maker, they heard about him, and they didn't give a shit. Finally, they said, okay, we'll see what you do. And they went to this literally unskiable spot, and the guy skied, okay? Still, he was starving. Then he goes to work a couple years later for this guy, Greg Stump, okay? Greg Stump makes a movie called The Blizzard of Oz. As a result, he ends up on the Today Show. He is still starving, okay? This is the way it is. It takes years to get notoriety. Most people give up. I mean, making it 50% is at most talent, you know? This is what I say all the time when I speak. My goal is to make people give up. Because if my life has been incredibly hard. I don't need to advertise. I'm in a very good spot right now, but I had huge health concerns, which were magnified by having no money. I remember having $18 in my bank account, writing bad checks for my rent, which thank God they didn't cash for a while. Most people are not willing to sacrifice that much. I'm not using it as an advertisement. But if you're not willing to sacrifice, the other thing is you have to look at the signals. If the signals say no, give the fuck up. Okay?
But are the signals true today? Are the signals that you're getting simple, that you make
a record. Chances are you'll play it for your friends and they say it's great.
Yeah.
Play for somebody you don't know. Well, they say it's great. They say it's great. That's a start.
Okay.
Almost always they say no. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. But people don't like that. I mean, it's like that old damn movie. You can't handle the truth. Or famous people, they write books and they say, everybody told me it was great. Yeah. Everybody you know said it was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But how about the people who are outside? Not that, of course, everyone's never going to agree. Every day people email me that I'm God and I'm a shithead simultaneously.
Of course.
But you have to feel like you're going in the right direction. If you're not getting those signals, change direction. It's like Sam Kinison said.
So
you know,
pivot.
No, Sam Kinison said, you don't want to be like a techie and analyze. Got to be an emotional thing. But Sam Kinison said, you know, when they were starving in Africa, stop sending food. Send them suitcases. They got to move.
All right, so let me switch gears here for a minute to also comment on technology and politics and culture. So let me start with technology since that's a logical leap from music. Were you a tinkerer as a kid?
Define that.
You know, were you interested in grabbing radios and tearing them apart?
No. I'm not Joe Walsh with a ham radio. Absolutely not. Uh-huh. I do have a very good mechanical sense, and I like figuring things out. But I'm not that guy in the home workshop, no. Yeah.
So what got you really interested in technology? Okay, well, you
know, starting my newsletter, I was reading Billboard, which goes up and down. It was in a bad point. This is 1986. And I read this. I go, this is terrible. Uh-huh. You know, I could do a better job. And I went home and woke up my girlfriend. And I said, I have this idea to do this newsletter. She said, do it. Okay. Now, to do it, you needed a computer. I famously said, and ironically, the era is here now, I'm not going to get a computer until I can talk to it, okay? So I did the research.
You would have been waiting for 30 years.
So, although I did learn to type in high school, probably the best course I took in high school. Mm. So I did a little research, and I'm a good researcher. Research, of course, was harder then because there was no internet. And you needed an Apple Macintosh because they had this program, PageMaker.
Oh, yeah, desktop publishing. Okay. Right. Mm-hmm.
So I bought the computer, Macintosh Plus. It was so fascinating that it hooked me, okay? And people have to know the computers are so good at this point, you really don't have to know how they work. But until they got to OS X and maybe Windows 7.
To me, that's the genius of Jobs. Right.
You literally had to know.
Yeah. Yeah. You had to, at that time.
You know, even at this late date, you know, I'll read Mac Life came the other day and they're giving the genius tips with the genius. I know those things. Not because I'm a genius, but I've lived through 30 years worth of computer history. Mm-hmm. I know what to look for and I know what to do. And I find it utterly fascinating. But we are at the end. From 1995, even though I started in 86, 1995 to 2015 was the tech era. That era is done, okay? It's like the guys just left Instagram. You'll remember we were excited about new apps. There aren't any new apps anymore. Go to a festival, they'll give you an app, okay? So it's just like music. We have figured it out, music. If you don't agree with me, stop listening and give up because you don't get it. Distribution has been figured out. Now it's about content again. How do you get your content gone. There's not some big technological breakthrough. People say, what's after Spotify? There's nothing after Spotify.
Right.
Because it's on demand. Yeah. As long as you can get it on demand. Mm-hmm. But there will continue to be technological breakthroughs, but they're not driving the country right now. So, and that's sad because I'm very excited about it, and I certainly still read about it, and we have 5G coming, and to what degree will 5G contribute to driverless cars, et cetera, but it is not, it's like reading about the Instagram founders leaving the other day. I got stimulated in a way that I didn't used to get stimulated. In terms of tech.
Because you think they're going to leave. And
I remember when you're trying to put the pieces together. Yeah. I mean, at this point in time, it's more interesting putting the pieces together on politics. It's not so much the horse race or the battle, but what is really going on in America? You know, this is where music has lost its touch. Music can mobilize Americans, but music is seen as entertainment. And therefore, you know, unfortunately, television has more power than music.
Today, because that's where, you know, the best writers and producers and directors are going
television,
these days.
Think about this the other night, okay?
And you about, and you mean on-demand television. You mean like binge-worthy shows.
Let's talk all television. Mm-hmm. What the breakthrough was Netflix. And Netflix didn't even know – Netflix got cold feet. Netflix used to mail the DVDs, said we're going to go to streaming. Mm-hmm. Then the public freaked out. The public was behind, and they went to streaming, which is essentially on demand. All these opportunities are rising, and we're in the middle of a fight right now. You know, what's going to happen with Disney's on-demand channels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you can only pay for so many on-demand channels.
Exactly, and they don't understand that. So it's very exciting. In addition—
Unless everything's a la carte, I guess you could do that.
Let's break this down. First, let's go content, okay? Everywhere you go, everybody wants to talk television. That's the way it was with music in the 60s and 70s. What are you watching? Is this good? Let me check it out, et cetera. You know, as George DeCoulias, who is a record producer and is now a music supervisor, said, I used to fight about records. You don't fight about records anymore, okay? Distribution.
Nobody's that invested.
Right.
When you talk about
television, the great thing about this is the movie studios and the TV companies, they believe they're entitled. Oh, people won't steal our product. So it's hilarious. It's just like, you know, the record companies 15 years ago. Yes. So it's a game of musical chairs and not all will survive.
Yeah. You know, let me bring up something that that you do say, and that the music industry was a canary in the coal mine for disruption.
Absolutely.
And what you're saying now is that the studios, the movie and television studios are kind of going through that themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing about it, although it's a public company, you know, Reed Hastings started Netflix. He's got an investment. So many of these other people running mature corporations, they never really had a stake in the game. Okay. So everybody working in the music business with these big corporations now, it's when you get independent people with their own money at stake that you see the revolution.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the Lefset's letter went digital in 2000.
Yes.
Right? And now you can reach a much wider audience. It's not just industry types. It's the hoi polloi. It's
schmucks
like me.
Yeah, exactly. That's for sure.
So did the feedback dumb down at all, or were you in a better position by touching closer to the ground?
There's a lot of stuff there. I had a free subscription to AOL in 1991 or 92 from Warner Brothers Records. So when the revolution hit in 1995, I was online 24/7. I lost
it,
at least 5 years of my life because I didn't have to pay when they were charging by the minute. And I checked out all the nook and crannies.
Yeah.
It was an accident how I took my newsletter online in the year 2000 because I had this book, The Operator, written about David Geffen. A weekend before anybody else got it, some friends in the music business, in the book business. And I wrote about it and I sent it to my subscribers and I noticed a virality. There were a lot of things I was on the cutting edge of that everyone knows about just by being there, okay? Like internet hate. Now they have hate tweets on Kimmel. I used to go places, tell people, they would not know what I'm talking about. So it used to be prior to the year 2005, you had to ask to be on my newsletter. Starting in 2005 to this day, you can sign up automatically. I don't move fast on change like this. Like everyone said, go to a blog format. And I said, no, I'm going to stay with email because a lot of my audience is really not technologically savvy, which was true. People, execs had their email printed out, et cetera.
Right.
But then, of course, blogs went back to email. So, and now email's king, and there are too many email newsletters. But I didn't go automatic till 2005, which was good because I was ready to deal with the feedback at that point.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in time, yes, I mean, I would put it a positive way. If I write about anybody in the world, they read it, and I get off on that. Okay.
Oh, I'm sure. It's gotta be an ego stroke.
You know,
whether good or bad.
I mean, and there's all kinds of crazy things. I write about Siggy's yogurt, and I hear from Siggy's, and people send me stuff, and that's cool. But that is a great thrill. Or, to hear from Elton or any of these other famous musicians.
Right.
And I could tell story after story. But reaching a wider audience is, I'm first and foremost a writer. Pretty much everybody writing about the music business, that is secondary to being in the music business. So, and I want my stuff to be first and foremost readable. Okay. So the more people who read what I'm writing, the more rewarding it is.
I read it as a gut check. It's in fact, I so often find myself going, "What? This just happened like 3 hours ago," and here you are with a quality take.
I'm a big believer. You can overanalyze your position and lose it.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean I have things happen, and sometimes I'm not sure of my take. But usually, listen, I'm reading all day long. Okay, I'm not the guy who's on the phone going to lunch, etc. So usually when this stuff happens, it's not out of the blue. I have a huge background in what's going on. I mean, like one of the things I did, I write an April Fool's joke every year, and I talked about Apple buying Beats. I didn't pull that out of my ass. It all made sense, okay? And then it happened, and then, CNBC and all these people called me as a TV in Toronto.
Exactly. Right.
But it wasn't because I was sitting at home, these were things that made sense to me.
Yeah. And being in the music business, you may have heard some scuttlebutt and rumor.
If you're looking right now at the landscape, the three major labels, their asset is their catalogs.
Mm-hmm.
They wield that to make deals. Their other big asset is relationships at radio. And as a result of the Spitzer decisions, very hard to get an independent record on major terrestrial radio, which is counterintuitive, but that's the way it is. So as we sit here and we see, okay, the power of terrestrial radio is fading, power of television is fading, except for CBS Sunday morning, that allows independent people to play. We, of course, have Chance the Rapper, but you have to analyze many issues. The other thing the major labels have is they're in the business 24/7. If you are an artist and you just want to, Trent Reznor left Interscope and then went ultimately back to Sony because you need someone who's talking to everybody all the time.
Mm.
Could there be an individual who creates an enterprise that could compete with the major labels? Absolutely. Now, the best and the brightest don't want to go into the music business for two reasons. There's literally not enough money in it, okay? Mm-hmm. You go in tech, although it's a very hard road, or you go into finance, which is not quite a hard road, you can make a ton of money that is just not there in the music business,
right?
Okay? Which it was in the days of the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
So not only was it sexy, but you could make a living at it.
That's why a lot of people,
they still want to go into the music business.
So there could be change.
So, as we've brought up a couple of times, the crash, canary in the coal mine, the record industry, Napster, 2000, and your newsletter is much more widely read. You're starting to offer advice to unknowns directly from the newsletter.
Right.
So, how do you think that's gone? I mean, now you've been doing that for 20 years, right?
Well, yeah, but if you're talking about the specific questions you had as opposed to the broad things, in terms of giving people advice, I always remember Bob Dylan saying, "Don't listen to me, I'm just another guy, what do I know?" And at first you said, no, it's Bob Dylan, but I understand that position. And I also quote this song Lighthouse off the album Gorilla by James Taylor. Just because I might be standing here, that don't mean I won't be wrong this time. You could follow me and lose your mind. But I also want to be the antidote to a lot of crap. I mean, if you play your music, if you can get it heard by a professional in this business, they're never going to tell you it sucks.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you had a question?
Well, just, you know, you are a truth teller. You have no chains. You're completely away from any beholden to anybody.
Right. People know what the truth is. It resonates.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're sick of being fed bullshit.
Well, they can find it on their little device in 5 minutes, whether something is true or not.
Even emotional truth,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
People know and it resonates. So that's my identity. You know, if you take the money, yeah, at this point people don't offer me a lot of things because they know that I won't take them. I won't play the game. But – if you do take something, you're owed people don't understand it's a relationship favor business. Someone does a favor for you, you owe a favor.
That's right.
And you're part of the maelstrom immediately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So we talked about, the Blackie Lawless situation.
Okay, but before we go back there, because I don't think I fully answered your question about going to the internet.
Yes, please.
Two things. Yes, a lot more opportunities come up. Okay. Like I was in India a month ago. That was a paying gig. I'm going to Dublin to interview Bob Geldof. That's a paying gig. I'm going to go to Iceland. That's a paying gig. Because my newsletter is free, I reach all these people.
It's global.
Okay?
Right.
And so people have talked about – this isn't a big discussion at this point, but giving it away for free. I've done much better since by giving it away for free. And the turning – there were numerous turning points. First, I was the expert on Napster because I'm going to be an attorney. I can see the issues. Uh-huh. And hearing from everybody, Hillary Rosen, head of RIAA, that was fascinating. And then going to England – with Tony Wilson, King of Manchester, 2004, the first time. That was great. So there are these significant things that happen. So anyway, you were talking about back to Blackie Lawless, et cetera.
Well, my point is that, by being a truth teller, you have famously, laid it out as you see fit, and
that's why I lost my gig,
and that's why you lost your job, but which then led to the newsletter, and then you've also got into some pretty public feuds, and I don't want to get into all of them, like Gene Simmons or that. No, there's one that I think is really special,
okay,
and that is I think you're the only curmudgeonly critic to get a top 10 hit written about them.
Okay, Taylor Swift wrote a song about me. This is. I said I wouldn't talk about it anymore just because everyone asked me about it. Very quickly, I was a fan. She was a teenage Joni Mitchell singing about her emotions. I went to see her.
She was authentic when she started.
Yes, I went to see her at the at Staples Center. It was an unbelievable experience. I was the first person who was not from country who was into it. When you are into something, believe me, you hear from everybody involved. Hear from her father, hear from her, etc. But I was constantly hearing that she could not sing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not going to write that without demonstration. Everyone knows that she appeared on the Grammy. She did a duet with Stevie Nicks. That could be the most horrific singing performance in the history of the Grammys. And I wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately she wrote a song about me. That's kind of what happened.
Yeah, called Mean.
If it's a
Grammy winning song. I think
if a Grammy means anything.
Rolling Stone calls it, ranks it number 24 on the all-time country list.
I didn't know that.
I don't know.
I stopped commenting for a couple of years until John Mayer, she wrote Dear John about John Mayer, and he said, that he was humiliated, et cetera, et cetera. And at this point in time, that was the third album. She's changed direction. She's gone pop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's written her history such that people can judge who they think she is.
Mm-hmm.
She has hardcore fans, everybody, but I don't think my judgment needs to be added in. Everybody else has their own judgment.
It was for a moment, and I don't know, maybe you spurred her on to improve her vocal qualities.
I think that's something that's inbred, you're born with, but I don't have a further answer.
All right, so why have you never written a book?
Okay, generally speaking, a book is either fiction, which all the big agents want primarily, they don't want nonfiction, or an idea. I have a friend, Roger McNamee. He just wrote a big book. He's one of the original investors in Facebook, and he's been a very vocal critic of Facebook and how it was manipulated, et cetera. He's now written a book. He emails me in August saying his book is coming out in February. February's too late, okay? I'm reaching people every day. People write these books. They get a big advance, and they sell 10,000 copies. If I sold 10, if I reached 10,000 copies, I'd shoot myself. I'd give up, you know. So this is New York media. They have it totally wrong. Okay. The book is, you write a novel, fantastic. Okay. But you're writing these books. I reach light years more people than anybody who writes any of these books. Why would I want to slow myself down, take myself out of the daily maelstrom to play a game that is irrelevant? Some people say, well, it's a badge of honor. You say, here, you have my book. And I'm not a game player. I'd rather write every day.
Okay. So we've talked about the music industry, a little technology, a little politics. So let's talk about today, Mr. Guru. It appears the music industry is back in good health.
Well, the record,
but there are challenges.
Let's be very clear. The recorded music industry, which is just part, is rebounding. Live has been skyrocketing for 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. And isn't that really the what we want from music is the live experience? Isn't really the record? And back in the day, let's face it, the tour, you know, supported the recording, and the recording was where the money was. And that has shifted 180 degrees. And but the fact is if you can go out there on the road and put a quality show out for the audience, you can actually make a pretty good living.
We got a lot of things going there. You know, after the second album, Steely Dan stopped going on the road, and their records only became more and more successful. And I love listening to those records. I love going to see Steely Dan, especially when they were at the Universal Amphitheater, and play those records live. I believe they're two different experiences. There are certain acts, you know, Grateful Dead being legendary, where the live experience was radically different from the record, okay? Mm-hmm. But I'm one of those people who views the live experience as being religious experience. Although I like going to the festival, et cetera, I like going to the, and I remember when they still had chairs in these venues, and sitting and bonding with the music. Going and hanging with the people is a separate thing. I recognize that. That is not necessarily what appeals to me. So for me, both things appeal. I don't believe live eclipses. And we go further down the rabbit hole from there.
So, okay, so what I hear is that they are two completely different things.
Well, they're both music.
And they intersect.
Yes.
You get a certain level of emotional joy in one way, and you experience it in a different way in between the live and recording.
Yes, there's nothing better than going to a gig and the band plays the album cut that was never on the radio that you loved. And you just gavel, and you just can't believe it. You're warm all over.
Yeah, it's like a religious experience.
Right.
It definitely is. You have an interesting take on today's ticketing system and how you think it might be better served for the audience.
Well, I've written a lot about it. You'll have to illuminate exactly what the question is.
Just that the way that the ticketing services are done today is poorly
most
run.
Most people don't understand ticketing. It's very opaque. It's one of the few areas with subterfuge today. Let's start at the end. When you see the ad in the paper that the show is on sale at the arena, let's just call it 20,000 seats, although that's a big arena. There could be, in many cases, fewer than 1,000 seats available. So the audience is very sophisticated. They know if they want to go to the show they want to go to, they'll either have to join the fan club, get an Amex or a Chase card, buy from a scalper, go to StubHub, etc. On some level, options are better than ever because it used to be if you didn't get the seats at the lineup, you couldn't go.
Right.
But it needs to be more clear, and it's not going in that direction.
Do you think that that will happen? Do you think that that's a supply and demand issue that the public will demand that?
The players involved like it this way.
They do.
And until there's an incentive for them to change it, there will be no change. Mm-hmm. Ticketmaster is paid by the acts to take heat. Everybody hates Ticketmaster. They love the acts. That's another reason why the acts won't charge what the real price of the ticket is. They're afraid of bad reflection. So if you have a ticket fee, okay, the reason there are fees is because essentially all of the ticket revenue other than the fee goes to the act.
All right. All right. Okay. So let's talk about Bob Lefsetz today. You know, the backbone is the Lefsetz letter.
Absolutely.
You have a podcast on TuneIn.
We're switching distributors, but was on TuneIn, going to a new one.
Oh, okay. And then you now have a show on Sirius XM.
I certainly do.
Mm-hmm. Now, and that's a live show, right? A call-in
show. Usually live.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've only had a couple. I think this is really...
As we do this, I've done three.
So how's it going so far?
You know, I love doing radio. I used to have a show on KLSX every Sunday night here in Los Angeles until it flipped format. It's great. What's to complain about?
What do you think of Sirius XM buying Pandora?
You know, this is a very – I think they had a huge investment in Pandora, mm-hmm. and it can only be advantageous to them. To what degree they utilize it, we'll have to see.
All right. And then finally, you're about ready to head out on tour.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
It's like I think of the Depeche Mode song of Route 66. Don't forget the Tacoma, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But this was Jason Flom's idea. For those people who don't know Jason Flom, the most successful A&R guy working in the business mm-hmm. today.
Yeah.
He made everybody from Lord to Katy Perry to Kid Rock. It goes on.
Greta Van Fleet for
exactly,
us rock fans.
That's now. Yeah. And I had him on my podcast back in February, and he said he got more feedback doing my podcast than he had doing anything else. So he then said, why don't we go on the road? And since Jason is so successful, I said yes. That was like 11 o'clock at night in Toronto. I wake up the next day. He's already got an agent. He's got it all planned out. Mark Geiger, WME, who runs WME, that's the merger of William Morris and Endeavor. He is the agent. We're starting in Boston, going to Toronto, then Brooklyn, then Manhattan, then Los Angeles, then San Francisco. Tickets are very inexpensive, $20 to $35. There are fees on top of that. We don't get the fees. We might not even make any money at all. This is an experiment to check demand. If you want to see us ever again, you better come.
Right.
And he'll be interviewing me. I'll be interviewing him. And people will be able to get questions up close and personal. So... should be fun. It's, you know, first date is in Boston in middle of October. Go to leftsetsversusflom.com and you can see all the dates.
Get all tickets. Right. Last question. So let me finish by putting your art history cap on.
Oh, Jesus.
Where does rock and roll, and I mean, you know, the music that drove the culture, fit in the pantheon of art movements in history?
I believe that music is the most immediate medium. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to
instantaneous satisfaction.
The number one thing is sex. People say, you know, nothing can compete with sex. You know, if some nerd is playing video games and someone says you want to have sex, they say, I'm going to play video games. Music, when done right, okay, when Kurt Cobain offed himself. Andy Rooney was on 60 Minutes saying what a waste it was. And the next day I was on the phone with Eddie Rosenblatt, who was head of Geffen Records. And Nirvana was on DGC, which was a part of Geffen Records. And we're talking about how terrible it was, what Andy Rooney had done. And Eddie said, and I've given him credit all the time, he said, movies when done right are larger than life. Music when done right is life itself. You listen to Joni Mitchell records, even AC/DC records, you say, that's them.
Yeah.
That's one of the bad things, the Mariah Carey era, although she wrote some of her songs supposedly. People think it's about melisma, et cetera. We've lost touch. We're far from the garden of the person singing their own song. Mm-hmm. It's like when you have 18 people making
producers
a
record. Producers and
that's,
writers.
That's why I love those initial Taylor Swift records.
Yeah.
They were co-written with Liz Rose, but they were literally her emotions.
Yeah.
So music touches you in a way. It's not only the lyrics. It moves your body. I mean, no one says, oh, we're going to have sex. Let's turn on the TV. Let's say, let's put on some music. Music is the mood. So I put music at the peak, and I would put painting and sculpture and television and movies beneath music. That doesn't mean music doesn't wax and wane in importance and execution, but I believe music is the number one art form.
Bob Lefsetz, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be here. And listen, you're a very informed, erudite guy.
Nice. Thank you, Bob Lefsetz. Funny and pointed stuff there. And it was a gas to talk with someone who shares our passion for the real deal, the genuine article for authentic rock and roll. Like we said at the top, Bob's online blog is a regular stop for us, and we highly recommend it. It's spelled L-E-F-S-E-T-Z, so lefsetz.com/WordPress. Go check it out right now, and you can thank us later. Bob can also be found live on the XM Sirius Satellite Radio, the volume channel 106 on Tuesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern and 4 p.m. Pacific. Finally, Bob and his dear friend, record exec, talent scout extraordinaire, and philanthropist Jason Flom are out on a no-holds-barred tour. Check local listings or the show notes to see when they are coming to your town. But if you want to see them and catch some of the R&RA team, I can tell you we will be catching them October 30th at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. Thanks again to Bob Lefsetz, and thank you for stopping by and popping in those earbuds. I'm Christian Swain, and this has been Deeper Digs in Rock, a production of Rock and Roll Archaeology. Peace out, and as always, keep up the rockin'.
To help right the wrongs of social injustice? Oxfam America works with people in more than 90 countries to save lives, develop long-term solutions to poverty, and campaign for social change. And we do it with the help of our friends in the music world. The Beatles were Oxfam supporters back in the day. So were the Stones. And through the years, musicians and music fans have helped Oxfam push hard to work for a just world without poverty. Folks like Radiohead, Coldplay, Pearl Jam, DJ Shadow, and many, many more have encouraged their fans to join the effort. You can too. Go to OxfamAmerica.org to learn how you can help.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Playlists can be found at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rnrap.com for more information.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.